Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, as Stockton tries to get out from under a mountain of debt, a federal court will decide, is the city allowed to declare bankruptcy? Then Vallejo did it 5 years ago. What did they learn from hitting bottom?
Bankruptcy is horribly expensive. It's a morale killer, and its long-lasting effects are pretty devastating. So if there's some way to avoid it, it's not the best solution.
Also, the long legal road for Prop 8 as the U.S. Supreme Court takes up California's ban on gay marriage, and why people flock to Arizona for baseball spring training.
Everybody's closer to everything, and there's nothing like the sound of the ball hitting the bat in the desert. It's just a beautiful thing.
It's the California Report. And we begin today in Stockton, a Central Valley city that owns a bunch of superlatives it doesn't really want. America's foreclosure capital, annual contender on the Forbes Most Miserable City list, and the largest U.S. city to declare bankruptcy. And next week, a federal court will consider this question. What exactly does it mean for a city to be bankrupt? The California Report's Sacramento Bureau Chief Scott Detrow reports.
When you visit Stockton, it isn't always obvious you're in America's largest bankrupt city. Take the gleaming downtown Stockton Arena. Sitting in the stands watching the Stockton Thunder play hockey, Stockton seems pretty nice. Fans like Leonard Cabrera say they appreciate the arena, which is part of a broader entertainment complex, including a baseball stadium and hotel.
We've come here before to see WWE events and stuff like that. So, you know, I think it's used positively.
Drive a couple miles, though, and it's a different picture. I'm standing here looking at Fair Oaks Public Library, or what used to be Fair Oaks Public Library. The doors are boarded up, the signs are whited out, and the only thing in the parking lot, aside from my car, are two abandoned mattresses. The city closed Fair Oaks Public Library in 2010. The library and the arena have more in common than you'd think. Things were going pretty well for Stockton in the early 2000s. Revenue was up, property values were exploding. The city borrowed more than $100 million to build the arena, the adjoining baseball stadium, and a brand new waterfront.
And they were all excellent projects, but it was a huge amount of debt.
Kathy Miller is a Stockton city councilwoman and served as vice mayor when the city declared bankruptcy last year. The borrowing, combined with the bill for generous employee benefits that we'll get to in a minute, put Stockton on the hook for a lot of money. And then the bottom fell out.
The recession hit and our revenues plummeted. We went from a high of about $205 million down to last year about $155 million. Mm-hmm. So no matter how you slice it, that is a huge reduction.
Stockton slashed and slashed, cutting $90 million from its budget between 2010 and 2012. It reduced employee pay, it shuttered the Fair Oaks Library, and reduced hours at other locations. The city cut the police department by a quarter and laid off more than 30 firefighters. But last year, Stockton still faced a $26 million deficit, so it declared bankruptcy.
Imaginez qu'il y a 10 ans, Stockton, 290 000 habitants, était l'une des cités les plus florissantes de Californie.
The decision attracted international attention. Al Seibel worked for Stockton for 33 years. He says he's been interviewed by reporters from France, Belgium, Japan, and Switzerland. Seibel maintained Stockton's parks. He's one of more than 1,000 Stockton retirees who suddenly lost their health insurance when the city declared bankruptcy.
My wife and I both have several conditions. I've had a heart attack in the past. I've had bleeding ulcers in the past.
In the 1990s, Stockton started offering lifetime health care benefits to its employees. When the recession hit, the city couldn't afford the plan, and the council voted to eliminate it. Stockton allowed retirees to stay on its plan for another year at a much higher rate. The 61-year-old Seibel had two options: pay a monthly premium of more than $1,100 for health care, or go without insurance until he qualifies for Medicare.
I only get $2,100 a month, and by the time I paid that insurance and paid my mortgage, I would have nothing left. So it really wasn't a choice. It was just forced on me.
The decision left Seibel and other retirees outraged and unprepared.
When you're given something in a written contract that you've worked for 33 years, you expect that to hold water.
Stockton's city manager and mayor both turned down repeated requests for interviews. Councilwoman Kathy Miller voted to eliminate the health care. She says the city didn't have any other option.
I think that more than any other decision was the toughest one for the council to make. But that was a budget expense that was going to go from $9 million to $14 million in 12 months and just grew exponentially.
The city justified eliminating retirees' health care by saying it was the only way to protect pensions, which weren't cut. But that decision is now being challenged by the insurance companies that are holding the bag on the hundreds of millions of dollars that Stockton owes in bond payments. Penn Law School professor David Skeel is a bankruptcy expert.
What the bond insurers want to say is you can't do anything to us unless you're making cuts everywhere you can. And the elephant in the room is Stockton's pensions.
The bond insurers will make their case in federal court next week. Skeel says the insurers are pressing the issue hard because they're worried about the growing number of cities going broke.
If you're a bond insurer, you say, oh my, I didn't think this could ever happen.
Skeel says even though Stockton's financial problems are extreme, its dynamics are similar to other broke cities like Vallejo and San Bernardino. He says local governments across the state, across the country, should pay attention.
When is it okay to go back on promises that you made to these employees, you know, and what limitations ought there be on that? You know, who should be held responsible and how widely should the sacrifice be shared? I mean, these are big questions, I think.
The federal hearing will determine whether Stockton has the legal right to declare bankruptcy. It begins Monday and is expected to last at least 3 days. For the California Report, I'm Scott Detrow in Stockton.
If Stockton wants a peek into its future, it might look toward Vallejo, a blue-collar town on the northern edge of San Francisco Bay. 5 years ago, with the city unable to balance its budget and crushed under a mountain of debt, Vallejo declared bankruptcy. It was just weeks into Osby Davis's first term as mayor.
I spent the first 6 months attempting not to file bankruptcy, trying to find a way out, finance our way out, negotiate our way out, wait our way out, and none of that worked.
The city treasury was empty, and Vallejo simply couldn't afford the rising costs of wages and retirement benefits for city workers. Shortly after bankruptcy, the economy fell into a deep recession, worsening the city's fiscal ditch. Vallejo slashed and scratched its way towards solvency. It emerged from bankruptcy 3 years later, but its budget still isn't balanced. We traveled to Vallejo this month to see what scars remain from the bankruptcy and how people have adapted.
This door was about ready to fall off the hinges and paint's peeling off the wall back here.
Vallejo Police Chief Joseph Crines is giving me a tour of police headquarters, a modest two-story building not far from downtown.
This building was in horrific shape. Paint peeling off the walls, carpeting that was horrible. And in these past several months now, we've painted the entire inside of this building, replaced all the carpeting, replaced some flooring. And those seem like little things, but it's a big, big deal when you talk about your working condition.
Chief Crines got here last year after the city escaped bankruptcy. He was brought in to pick up the pieces. The number of police officers had fallen by nearly half, from about 155 cops down to 85. Almost anyone, including Chief Crines, will tell you it left the city in peril.
On our graveyard shifts, for example, say after 2 o'clock in the morning, quite frequently, we're running with a sergeant and about 5 or 6 police officers for a city of 115,000 people in 40 square miles, and those are ridiculously low numbers.
Today, Vallejo has no anti-gang unit. It's lost 10 of its 24 dispatchers. The result, says Chief Crines,
wherein we might have responded to calls, say, within an hour, and I'm talking about non-in-progress calls. Today it might take us hours and or if we respond at all.
On the city's waterfront on a recent sunny afternoon, Vallejo's money problems were nowhere to be found. Across the channel from Mare Island, the former naval shipyard that closed in 1996, parents and kids strolled along the sidewalk as fishermen cast their lines into the water. But city services and the quality of life have surely declined since the bankruptcy. The good news? Residents of Vallejo have stepped up.
We were a city, now we're a community, because so many of us have banded together to do something about it.
John Allen and two other community leaders are at the waterfront talking about how Vallejo has changed. Allen runs a program called Fighting Back Partnership, which helps battle crime. Allen says that after Vallejo fell into bankruptcy, residents here felt targeted by criminals from other cities.
Coming in here just feeling that they could get away with stuff, burglaries, home invasions, because the police couldn't respond to everything that was going on.
Since 2008, the number of community crime watch groups has ballooned to more than 400. They're all coordinated by an online newspaper called the Vallejo Lamplighter. The website was started by Ann Smith during a rash of crime.
The prostitution started about 6 o'clock with actually carloads of prostitutes driving up and beginning to phone and text John's, and they would start picking them up in front of my house and all around the corner.
The watch groups have helped restore a semblance of security to many Vallejo neighborhoods. But Smith says Vallejo's fall into the fiscal abyss has changed the way residents think about local government.
There's been a whole lot more political activism on the part of people in Vallejo. They've been going to city council meetings, demanding a higher accountability level. I think people are really motivated and interested in turning the town around and making sure we go back to being the kind of community we all envision.
Allen and Smith say they're both hopeful about the future, but Patrice Lewis of the local NAACP says she worries about a lingering stigma, the kind she felt as a student at Sacramento State.
I would tell people, oh, I live in the city of Vallejo, or I'm from Vallejo, and they would say, oh, the bankrupt city. It makes the people and the citizens lose morale overall, you know, because they have this label of being bankrupt when really, I think it's a great city.
Back in his office, Vallejo Mayor Osby Davis laments the toll bankruptcy has taken here, not just in public safety, but in the crumbling condition of city streets. And he says they just can't keep up.
So they're getting worse by the day as opposed to better, even though we're putting money into paving our streets.
The mayor notes that despite the spending cuts, Vallejo's budget is still not in balance. The final piece, he says, squeezing more concessions from the city's police officers union. Progress in those talks is slow, and the union president says they've already given back what they were asked, that further cuts will only make it harder to attract and keep police officers. For Vallejo, the worst of the bankruptcy is now over. But as a fix for fiscal problems, city manager Dan Keene doesn't recommend it.
Bankruptcy is horribly expensive, it's a morale killer, and its long-lasting effects are pretty devastating. So I would always advise, if there's some way to avoid it, it's not the best solution.
The good news, says Keene, Standard & Poor's recently upgraded, just slightly, one of the city's bond ratings. On Tuesday, more than 4 years after California voters approved Proposition 8, the state's ban on same-sex marriage gets a full hearing before the U.S. Supreme Court. It's been a long and winding road to the High Court, a road paved with joy, anger, euphoria, and fear. You might say it began on May 15, 2008, when the California Supreme Court ruled that gay and lesbian couples had a legal right to marry.
As California goes, so goes the rest of the nation.
San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom celebrated at City Hall.
It's inevitable. This door is wide open now. It's going to happen. Whether you like it or not, this is the future, and it's now.
Gay Californians, including San Franciscan John Lewis, were thrilled.
The court articulated the most basic principles of humanity, fairness and love.
But the historic ruling infuriated supporters of traditional marriage, including Randy Thomason with the group Protect Marriage.
The main thing this is going to do is it will spur Californians to go to the polls to override the judges and protect marriage licenses for one man and one woman in the California Constitution.
2 weeks later, Thomason's group submitted more than 1 million signatures for a ballot measure to do just that, Proposition 8. In the months before the November election, gay and lesbian couples flocked to county clerk's offices to take out marriage licenses.
Brad, do you take Paul to be your lawful wedded spouse, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish as long as you both shall live?
I do!
Even as couples celebrated, the two sides geared up for an expensive and emotional campaign.
One man, one woman, yes on eight. One man, one woman, yes on eight.
Less than a month before the election, with polls showing Prop 8 slightly behind, thousands of people jammed the lawn of the state capitol for a rally sponsored by the Calvary Christian Center in Sacramento and its Reverend Philip Godeau.
Listen to me, this is not about a civil rights issue. It's about a moral issue. It's about right and wrong.
Altogether, more than $80 million were spent. The Yes on 8 campaign produced ads warning parents what would happen if Prop 8 failed.
Some say that gay marriage doesn't have anything to do with schools.
But it has everything to do with schools.
After Massachusetts legalized gay marriage, our son came home and told us the school taught him that boys can marry other boys. He's in second grade.
On election night, opponents of gay marriage claimed a narrow victory, 52-48%.
And the battle tonight has been won. We are now projecting Proposition 8 has passed.
But the fight didn't end there. Gay rights supporters immediately asked the California Supreme Court to overturn Prop 8. But in 2009, the court upheld the measure, sparking anger in the gay community. The ruling was the end of the road in state court, but it marked the beginning of a new journey through federal court. A male couple from Los Angeles and two lesbians from Berkeley filed a lawsuit against the measure in federal district court. One of the plaintiffs is Paul Katami.
We're not asking to be tolerated or accepted. What we're asking for is a basic civil right, that we should have the opportunity to access that right, and we should be full participants as citizens of the United States of America.
Their legal team was led by two high-profile attorneys, David Boies and Theodore Olson, who argued opposite sides when the U.S. Supreme Court took up the disputed 2000 presidential election between Al Gore and George W. Bush. The real surprise was Olson, a conservative stalwart.
The case we filed is not about liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican. This case is about the equal rights guaranteed to every American under the United States Constitution.
But Andrew Pugno, an attorney with the Yes on 8 campaign, argued that the lawsuit was a legal assault on traditional marriage.
The Constitution is there to protect individual rights, and we agree with that completely. But that is not what is being sought here. What is being sought here is a deinstitutionalizing of an existing social structure.
In August of 2010, after a 2-week trial in San Francisco, federal judge Vaughn Walker issued a sweeping decision, declaring Proposition 8 unconstitutional. Walker wrote that there was no rational basis for government to prevent gay and lesbian couples from marrying, and that doing so violated equal protection under the law guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. As gay marriage advocates celebrated, Sacramento resident Luke Otterstad protested outside the courthouse.
And it's really upsetting to hear that one unelected judge just trampled on the votes of millions of Californians.
Opponents of same-sex marriage asked the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to overturn Judge Walker's decision. But in February of last year, a 3-judge panel voted 2-1 to uphold it. Now it's in the hands of the highest court in the land. A lot has changed since Prop 8 passed. In a recent poll, California voters said they now support same-sex marriage by a wide margin. The legal and political landscapes on gay marriage are shifting fast, surprising even former mayor and now Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom.
This trajectory has moved much faster than I think any pundit or politician ever could have imagined.
Oral arguments in the Prop 8 case are scheduled for Tuesday morning, and people on both sides of this historic case will no doubt be lining up early outside the Supreme Court for a chance to witness history. The justices will issue their decision later this year. I'll be in D.C. for oral arguments on Prop 8 and DOMA next week. Follow the California Report's coverage online at californiareport.org/Prop 8 and follow me on Twitter at Scott Schaefer. Cowboy singer Dave Stamey's Vaquero Song is a nostalgic look back at the rancho era of the 1840s, when California was still part of Mexico and vaqueros, or cowboys, rode the range. Stamey lived for 25 years on the site of one of the historic ranchos on the Central Coast, now the town of Napomo. As part of our series California Songs, Valerie Hamilton spoke to him about the state's first cowboys and the intersections of past and present.
My name is Juan Medina, a vaquero once was I. Now I live in the air above the pepper trees. And where are all the cattle that belong to Captain Dana? They are blown away like ashes in the California breeze.
Captain William Henry Dana, he was a sea captain from back east, and he was granted a 38,000 acre ranch on the central coast of California that was called Rancho Napomo.
I worked the hide and tallow trade in a land I loved. I rode in wooden stirrups, and the dust raised by my ponies was smoke from my altar offered up to God above.
The vaqueros were the ranch workers of the rancho era. They would predate the cowboys. They did it long before we had any of those boys from Texas show up. Quite often they were California Indians or Indian Mexican folks. They absolutely lived and died and everything else horseback. It was their pride and joy.
In the canyon and Barranca and the willows by the creek bank, I chased the wild cattle through the live oak trees, across Valley Ridge and Mesa.
When Captain Dana occupied his ranch, he built an adobe ranch house. They called it Casa Grande. And it's still there. If you stand in a certain place, you don't see any of the modern development. The land just kind of falls away toward a creek and then rises up again beyond that toward the foothills. And you could almost get a sense of what it was like to be there at that time in 1850 or 1860 to see what they saw. That was the genesis of the song.
I am still here, todavía estoy aquí. I am still here, todavía estoy aquí.
I like having a sense of history and the present being running along the same river. I think it makes you appreciate where you are so much more, and you can enjoy living where you are so much more if you know what happened here in that little canyon or up this little road.
Todavía estoy aquí, I am still here. Todavía estoy aquí, my soul is dancing in the moonlight.
A slice of history that I tried to catch in my hand real fast. And it didn't last that long. It only lasted for Captain Dana probably 15 years. And then right after that came the big drought that wiped out all the ranchos. So it was a brief little shining moment in history that was uniquely California in that it couldn't have happened anywhere else.
My name is Juan Medina, a vaquero once was I. Now I live in the air above the pepper trees.
That's Dave Stamey talking about the Vaquero Song. You can find it on his album, Tonopah. If you have a favorite California song, let us know at calreport@kqed.org. And finally today, baseball. The season kicks off March 31st, and all five of California's major league teams are in the desert getting ready. Every year, fans flock to spring training in Arizona to get a sneak peek of their teams and get a little sun. Gina Shalaba and Steve Julian talked to some of those fans this week.
Here's the starting lineup for your world champion, San Francisco Giants.
Growing up as a Giants fan, I've always wanted to go to spring training. I've always, you know, people I know, season ticket holders, diehard Giants fans have always come to Scottsdale. It's kind of a something that was on my bucket list to do. I wish it was like this in San Francisco every day. There's nothing better than being able to watch baseball in shorts and, you know, drink a beer and just enjoy the day.
Hey, Cole Mia here.
I'm Mark from right now Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We come out here to watch the Angels. Born and raised in Fullerton, California. So we keep coming out here
and
every
weather,
year.
Me and my brother. You're from Wisconsin. It was snowing
yesterday. Yeah, it was snowing this morning when we actually got here. So
right.
That was awesome.
I'm out here, I'm wearing A's gear. I think the Oakland A's are going to be, oh my God, they're going to be fire. They had an incredible season. It's unfortunate that they couldn't get past Detroit, but at the end of the day, A's are going to be dominating this year.
I wanted my children to experience how close it is, how intimate it is, and how, you know, how you get to get close to the players and really be a part of the atmosphere.
It doesn't matter who's playing. It's just a baseball game. It's the excitement and seeing people getting ready for the real games.
Everybody's closer to everything. And there's nothing like the sound of the ball hitting the bat in the desert. It's just a beautiful thing.
That's baseball fans Jeff Baer, Teresa Maxey, Daria Ogden, Rynell Williams, and Nicole Van Glahn at spring training in Arizona this week. That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can always find us online at californiareport.org. And we're on Facebook, too. Like us, if you like. And you can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Schaefer. Our director is Susie Rocho. Technical producer is Seal Muller. We have additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our intern is Guy Marzorati. Our editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Polly Stryker, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation. With nomination information about the 2014 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards available at www.irvine.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens in neighborhoods at calendow.org.